Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Hello, and welcome back to The Critic Books podcast. I'm Francesca Peacock, and this week, The Critic's deputy editor, Graham Stewart, speaks to Andrew Roberts about his new biography of George III. Subscribe to The Critic Books podcast on Spotify or Apple Podcasts so you never miss an episode.
Andrew Roberts, you're currently in New York where you're lecturing and promoting your new biography of King George III. In America, there is the perception that George III was a tyrant and a dictator. Before we get to some of the details of those claims and why you think they're unfair, can I ask, in constitutional terms, what dictatorial powers did George III possess or exercise?
Well, thank you very much, Graham, and thanks for having me on the show. And I wonder if I might just preface my remarks by saying what a huge admirer I am of The Critic. I think it's a really first-class publication, and so congratulations on it. The answer is that he was a constitutional monarch. Britain was a limited monarchy after the Glorious Revolution, and he worked with Parliament through the cabinet and the Prime Minister, and was not the kind of absolutist monarch that the Stuarts had been. In fact, that's why he was on the throne, because his family, the Hanoverians, were brought over because they weren't Catholics and they weren't absolutists. So it's important to remember, I think, about George III that he was in no sense a dictator in the way that the Whig historians tried to make him out to be in the 19th and early 20th centuries.
So why has he got such a bad rap then in that case? I mean, George the Second, George the First, even for all his personal failings, George the Fourth, haven't been given this treatment of what was being described as a dictator. Why has George III attracted such attacks for so long?
Two reasons, really. In America, obviously, it comes down to the accusations made by the founding fathers, particularly Thomas Jefferson in the Declaration of Independence, in which he's called a tyrant several times and also unfit to be the ruler of the free people. But in Britain, it's the work of the Whig historians, Macaulay, the Trevelyans, Henry Broome, and so on, who have attached this label to him because Edmund Burke and the radical Whigs accused him of this in the 1760s, 1770s, and 1780s. It stops with Edmund Burke, of course, by 1790 with the publication of Reflections on the Revolution in France. But there just simply isn't the evidence to back this up. He only on one occasion appointed a prime minister, William Pitt the Younger, who didn't have the confidence of the majority of the House of Commons. And on that occasion, he was swiftly vindicated by a general election victory of William Pitt the Younger's over Charles James Fox. And so that was validated.
Well, we'll come in a moment to his role and influence in the British Isles, but I want to focus initially on his role with the American colonies and the American Revolution or American War of Independence, depending on how you want to call it. It strikes me as quite interesting that both at the time and thereafter, the American revolutionaries and the founding fathers always hit upon George III as being the problem rather than the politicians in Westminster. Did they get the wrong man? And what was the politics behind that?
Well, it was the other way around in a sense, because up until 1776, they had concentrated on Parliament and they had been petitioning George III to sort of lead them against the British government, which George III, as I say, was a constitutional monarch and was not about to do. Had he been a tyrant, he might have tried to have gone down that route, but of course he wasn't and therefore didn't. Once the fighting had broken out, it was clear, just for sheer propaganda reasons, that you have to attack the head of state of the enemy power. And so George III came in for major attack, of course, in January 1776 in Thomas Paine's best-selling pamphlet, Common Sense, and then devastatingly in the Declaration of Independence. So what the Founding Fathers were trying to do was clothe themselves essentially in the mantle of the revolutionaries against Charles I of 1642 and of the revolutionaries against James II in 1688. And in order to do that, they had to try and make this perfectly reasonable constitutional monarch out to be a Stuart absolutist. And that's essentially what the Declaration's attempting to do.
Nevertheless, among the roles of a constitutional monarch is to warn and to encourage his ministers. Is it not nevertheless the case that George Neva warned against the dangers of government policy with the colonies? In fact, he was sympathetic towards it. And insofar as he encouraged the ministers, he encouraged them to take measures that proved disastrous.
Well, yes and no. To the first point, he perfectly understandably accepted what the royal governors were saying in America, which is that the rest of the provinces, as they were then called, would not stand by the Massachusetts Bay Colony, especially after the Boston Tea Party in December 1773. But I don't think it's fair to criticize him for sort of advising, encouraging and warning to take tougher stances than they otherwise would have. In fact, when one tough stance was put forward by Lord Hillsborough, the king warned him the other way and said that it was too early to try to pressurize the colonies. So it's true that he went along with Lord North, who he of course appointed and kept in power for 12 years, but he wasn't a driver of policy. He was somebody who went along with it.
Mm-hmm. So not a driver of policy. Did he have any meaningful role in the military strategy?
No, he didn't either. He approved the generals that were sent out, who were universally useless, in my view. He approved, he tried to persuade the one general who would have been useful, who had been commander-in-chief of the army, British Army in North America during the Seven Years' War, but he didn't want to get involved in what he saw as a sort of fratricidal conflict. And he also, this was a key area in which he was actually pretty bad when it came to recruitment, because he didn't want officers to be given commissions in new regiments that would devalue the commissions that the already existing old corps, as it's called, army officers had. So he sort of put precedent and commission values above the desperate need to get a large army out to America as soon as possible. One of the things that proves really that he wasn't a tyrant was that we didn't have an enormous army in America in the first place. You know, he didn't send any troops. The British government didn't send any troops to any city before the revolution broke out, except for Boston in 1768. And a tyrant would have done something along the lines of what Catherine the Great would have done, or Frederick the Great would have done, or the French were doing in Corsica, or the Spanish in New Orleans, which was to flood the colony with troops.
Is there nevertheless an argument that George could have been more receptive to alternative policies to keep the colonies, the sort of ideas that loyalist Americans like Joseph Galloway came up with? He didn't seem, you know, whenever he was handed a ball, he didn't seem to play it. Is that a fair accusation?
Well, I think it's fair to say that there were other ways that this could have panned out, and that people like Galloway were thinking creatively. Actually, earlier than that, Benjamin Franklin was also thinking creatively about a kind of Commonwealth concept. I mean, in a sense, of course, what should have happened is that the colonies should have been brought together, the 13 colonies, into a single unitary authority with its own parliament. And we ought to have had a Commonwealth set up. But of course, you don't get the British Commonwealth set up until 1931. Mm. And it takes the American War of Independence, essentially, to set up that whole concept with Australia and Canada and so on. So It's, I think, asking too much of the king to be able to look 100 years into the future, or to go along with what seemed like fairly radical plans of Galloway and others, which the Prime Minister and the Cabinet and the majority of the House of Commons and House of Lords didn't want.
Mm. Well, you're in America at the moment discussing George III as part of your book tour. What kind of reception are you getting from American audiences? Because for many of them, they must be hearing an argument for the first time that George III was neither the tyrant of Thomas Jefferson's imagination, nor the kind of preening buffoon as displayed in musicals like Hamilton.
Yes, they have been somewhat surprised, but I've been to the belly of the beast. I've been to Monticello, Thomas Jefferson's house, and to Mount Vernon, George Washington's house. It's been a 6-week book tour of five states, only two more days to go, and I haven't once experienced any ill temper or nationalism or jingoism or anything like that at all. Americans have been incredibly receptive, not just in the public meetings that I've been going to, but endless podcasts and Zooms and so on like that, to hear this this essentially revisionist rehabilitation or attempted rehabilitation of George III, that some of them found it amusing. But it's been selling tremendously well here, and it's seems to be being taken on board. I'm not for a moment suggesting that I'm ever going to be able to change most Americans' minds. There isn't a day that goes by. I subscribe to Google Alerts for King George III. There isn't a single day that goes by that in which he's not, in some American newspaper or website or whatever, referred to as a despot or a tyrant or a dictator.
Well, let's turn our gaze from America to Britain itself. It's one of the contentions of your book that he should be seen as an enlightened monarch, perhaps even a figure of the Enlightenment. What's your basis for portraying him in that way?
Oh, he was a hugely cultured figure, and very much an Enlightenment figure as well. One thinks of the Royal Academy, which he set up. The Royal Collection, which is now the largest private art collection in the world, half of the paintings of which were bought by George III, who patronised great artists of the day. He was, of course, a leading figure in patronising architects. The neoclassical Georgian architecture figures such as Robert Adam and William Chambers and James Wyatt and so on. He was very interested in music. He played four musical instruments. He invited Mozart over to play at Buckingham Palace. He tried to keep Haydn in the country. Handel said of him, "While that boy lives, my music needs no other protector." He was very interested, and this is a classic Enlightenment side with astronomy, where he helped build the largest telescope in the world to help William Herschel, and the planet Uranus was named after him. In fact, he had a library of 80,000 books, which formed the kernel of the British Library today. And he allowed scholars like Joseph Priestley and Samuel Johnson to come to Buckingham Palace and use his personal library. I think, you know, to call him as Tom Paine did in Common Sense, to call him the Royal Brute of Britain, is completely to get the wrong end of the stick. Again, just pure propaganda, wartime propaganda, perfectly understandable. Just like the Declaration of Independence's strictures are understandable, but we really don't need 200 years later to believe any of that kind of thing.
Well, after the American Revolution, there is, of course, the French Revolution that coincides with his reign. Did that see a rallying of popular support towards him, or did it further divide opinion?
No, huge rallying. It was very fortunate for him, and indeed the country, that the recovery from his from his second bout, but first major bout of what was called the King's Malady, took place only 3 or 4 months after the, before the fall of the Bastille. And then, of course, when in January 1793, the Louis the XVI's head was chopped off, and he had been, of course, the king's worst enemy on the international scene, tremendously helping the Americans to gain their independence. The king put the court into mourning because he recognised the threat that this would pose to his monarchy. And yet the exact opposite happened. In fact, there was a huge rallying, especially at the time of the terror in France. There was a huge rallying to the king, and he became more popular than ever.
Is there a sense that he was, when I say too much of a constitutional monarch, what I mean by that is he felt that the constitution was so perfect in its existing state that it was it could be profitably reformed?
I think that's fair, yes. I think one of the criticisms that could be levelled at him is that he revered the constitution so much, not least, of course, because it did give him enormous powers. Nonetheless, he didn't go along the route of parliamentary reform, for example, he was perfectly happy with the constitution as it stood, and didn't want to revise it. He saw himself as a protector of the constitution as opposed to somebody who ought to be tinkering with it. In that sense, he was a Tory.
Yes, so, I mean, he didn't want an extension of the franchise. Were there any social reforms that he personally backed?
Well, one of the things that I found most interesting in this, in the research and the writing of this book, which took me 3 years, and was primarily done with this fabulous thing, the Georgian Papers Programme, which in 2015, the Queen essentially allowed the Royal Archives and King's College London to, in this Georgian Papers programme, to put online 100,000 pages of George III's papers and memoranda and correspondence and so on. And in the course of that, I came across an essay that he wrote when he was Prince of Wales in the 1750s, in which he takes to pieces, it's an essay on Montesquieu's Essays on the Laws, he takes to pieces all of the arguments in favour of slavery. And he says that it's an execration and it's ludicrous and so on. And of course, he never bought or sold a slave in his life. He never owned a slave. He never owned shares in the companies that did that. He signed into law the abolition of the slave trade in 1807. And so one can see that, first of all, it's wrong to put him on the same moral plane as the signatories of the Declaration of Independence, 41 out of 56 of whom did own slaves. But then, of course, he, as king, just doesn't do anything about it. He doesn't intervene constitutionally and attempt to abolish the slave trade, which doesn't happen, of course, until 13 years after his death.
Mm-hmm. But he couldn't really be said to be religiously tolerant. I mean, he was a great supporter of the Anglican settlement and an opponent of Catholic emancipation. What was his thinking there?
Well, religiously tolerant in our view today, that's true. But actually, he was quite religiously tolerant for his own day. He was the first monarch to visit Catholics and stay with them in their houses and so on. He certainly had no animus against nonconformists or Jews or anything along those lines. So, you know, there's a big difference between our sort of omni-tolerance and 18th century tolerance, because he knew that the reason he was on the throne was because of his willingness to take the oath to protect the Protestant law, Protestant religion as by law established. So he had a dynastic reason to oppose Catholic emancipation. He'd taken that coronation oath. He also had seen the effects of Protestant anti-Catholic bigotry in the Gordon riots, which had led to the deaths of 400 people, and back in June 1780. And he didn't see it as his role to alter the religious settlement of the Glorious Revolution.
And that had consequences for Ireland as well, of course.
Well, and if you'd given the vote to all the Catholics in Ireland, especially after 1801, when the Ireland came into union with the rest of Britain, you'd have had the situation where suddenly an extra 100 seats in Parliament would have gone to essentially the Whigs and the parties supporting them, or at least the factions supporting them. So in that sense, he was holding up what ultimately did happen in the 19th century.
Mm-hmm. There are really two things that almost everyone knows about George III. The first, obviously, is the loss of the American colonies, but the second is what is often described as his period of madness. And Alan Bennett's play, The Madness of King George, and so on. It's your view that the common perception that it was porphyria he had, which is a hereditary blood disease, is not correct, and that he actually suffered a form of a bipolar disorder. What's your evidence for that?
Yes, it's not just my view. It's the view of most medical experts today. Quite extraordinarily, back in the late 1960s, a mother and son team gave completely misleading symptoms to doctors at the time who with these misleading symptoms, I'm afraid it's largely to do with the colour of the king's faeces and urine, came to the conclusion came to the diagnosis of porphyria. But we can now tell that it wasn't that at all. And there are three or four reasons that I set out in my appendix over this. But instead, it was, as you say, bipolar disorder affective type 1, a form of manic depression. And the evidence for it is overwhelming. It has been not just accepted, but sort of proselytized by several doctors, including porphyria experts, and also Sir Simon Wesley, the president, the only person to have been both president of the Royal Society of Physicians and the Royal Society of Psychiatrists. So do take a look at the appendix at the end of my book and go into it. But the conclusions are conclusive in my view.
Judged by characters of his two sons who succeeded him, the future George IV and William IV, is it fair to say he was either a poor father or an unlucky father?
No, he was a loving father who had a couple of absolutely dreadful children. That can happen to anybody. He was a kind and loving father who expected his children to be upright, decent, financially prudent, frugal, and usurious in the way that he was. Instead, he wound up with those two who were, and one might actually add Frederick, Duke of York, when he was young as well, who were drunken, lazy, sexually incontinent, and completely untrustworthy. So I don't know that you can blame that. His wife, Charlotte of Mecklenburg-Strelitz, who was also an extremely good mother, also can't be blamed. There was a structural aspect to it in that the Hanoverians all hated their parents and children. George III didn't hate his father, but they tended to, partly because they were sort of set up in opposition politically. And they all knew that when the new reign came, their debts would be paid off. So they didn't mind building up huge debts. And George IV, when he was Prince of Wales, built up a debt that was equal to the amount that the taxpayer was spending on the Royal Navy. He was completely financially incontinent. He never asked the price of anything. He was the sort of Imelda Marcos of the late 18th century when it came to spending on himself and his and his clones and so on. Mm-hmm.
And by contrast, George III was quite ascetic. I mean, insofar as you can live in palaces and be ascetic.
Exactly, yes. He didn't. He dressed as an English country gentleman, which of course allowed him to go around the fields and chat to farmers about pigs without an entourage, and they didn't know who he was, you know. So it's a world away from what's going on in Versailles, mm-hmm. Where the Bourbons all dressing up like, you know, Christmas trees and understandably getting the results that come from that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd like to end, if I may, by asking you what you think King George I's greatest legacy is.
I think King George III's greatest legacy, I would say, would be the modern monarchy. I think that we mentioned financial prudence. I think when one looks at the Queen, also the frugality of eating and drinking, the hard work that they both are known for, their sense of duty. When one looks at the King, he did lots of things that presaged the modern monarchy. He bought Buckingham House, now Buckingham Palace, bought the gold state coach, which is used on the great occasions. He was buried at Windsor, the first of the kings to do so since Charles I. Subsequently, all of the royal family, all of the monarchs are buried there. He invented the walkabout, the royal enclosure at Ascot, the annual trooping of the colour and so on. And so I think that's his greatest legacy today.
Well, Andrew Roberts, whose new biography of King George III is published by Alan Lane. It's reviewed by the historian Adam Zamoyski in the current December-January Christmas issue of The Critic magazine. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you so much, Graham. I've really enjoyed it.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website www.thecritic.co.uk.